the Beasley Broadcast Group. This is 1330 WRCA, Watertown, Boston.
Opinions expressed during the following paid program are those of the program producers and do not reflect the views of WRCA Radio, its staff, or management.
Good evening, ladies and gents. Welcome to the past. It's time for Tube Talk.
Stars shining right above you. Night breezes seem to whisper, I love you. Birds singing in sycamore tree. Dream a little dream of me. Say nighty night and kiss me. Just hold me tight and tell me you'll miss me. While I'm alone, blues can be. Dream a little dream of me. Stars fading, but I linger on, dear, still craving your kiss. I'm longing to linger till dawn, dear, just saying this. Sweet dreams till sunbeams find you. Sweet dreams that leave all worries behind you. But in your dreams, whatever they be, dream a little dream of me.
That was Benny Carter and his orchestra with All of Me. That's a recording from 1940. And prior to that, we had the Nat King Cole Trio. Music doesn't get any better than that. We are the Avengers of Analog. This is Tube Talk. Don't write off radio just yet, even though you may be listening over the internet. Don't do it. Each week, every Friday, we give you something swell to put in your ear. Like Frank Sinatra.
I have but one heart, this heart I bring you. I have but one heart to share with you. I have but one dream that I can cling to. You are the one dream I pray comes true. My darling, until I saw you, I never felt this way. And nobody else before you ever has heard me say, you are my one love. My life I live for you. I have but one heart to give to you. Vicino mare, facem amore, ancora, ancora, per ci sposare. So marinara, e terrò arezza, ma piala arezza, stanga morì. You are my one love, my life I live for you. I have but one heart to give to you.
Yes, imagine that. Beautiful voice. Harps in the background. Wonderful lyrics. You know, these are all the hallmarks of that great music that meant so much to so many people. And we relive it every Friday night here on Tube Talk on WRCA Radio 1330. Yes, my friends, you have reached the zenith of the independently produced fine radio experience. Tell all your pals, listen in, because this is the place to be. Email us with your questions, comments, concerns at tubetalk1@gmail.com. Also, you can visit us at tubetalkclassicradioshow.org. This is Victory Ball with Charlie Parker.
Thank you.
1949, that's the Victory Ball with Charlie Parker. And before we head off down to that radio parlor, the well-lit dial, the beautiful glowing numbers, the cozy chairs where we sit and discuss radio and what's wonderful about those classic sets and radio in general, before we head down to the radio parlor, maybe we can sneak in one more here. Here's Joe Stafford.
Long ago and far away, I dreamed a dream one day, and now here beside me. Long the skies were overcast, but now the clouds have passed. You're here at last. Chills run up and down my spine. The dream I dreamed was not denied me. Just one look and then I knew that all I had longed for long ago was you. Denied me just.
Our guest this evening on Tube Talk is Alan Finger from Golden Age Radio Repair and the New England Antique Radio Club. Alan, thanks for being on tonight.
Well, good evening. It's good to be here today.
Well, I tell you what, we're going to go into the fascinating world of radio phonographs. And it's something we haven't really addressed on the program extensively. But, you know, all of a sudden, we go from the world of radiolas and, you know, the old three dialers before that. And it's pretty much, you know, an all radio world. And then all of a sudden, we start to see, what is it? And you say in the early 30s, the phonograph gets added into the radio. How did this all happen?
Well, 1926 was the year that they started making electronically amplified phonographs. So it was logical at that point for them to graft the phonograph onto the radio. Before, it had been a separate box with a crank and a mechanical diaphragm type speaker.
So, you know, we enter the world then of really what became the home entertainment system of early radio, huh?
It was very much at that point.
And this would be a simple phonograph for what, playing 78s, basically?
Yeah, and usually they weren't. The original ones, many of them were fairly sophisticated record changers because they were limited to 78 RPM records. And at best, a 12-inch 78 could play for 4 minutes.
That's fascinating. Now, you know, and the other thing is, too, you run into this sometimes is, if you look at certain manufacturers' lines, there was the, you know, there was the top of the line set always seemed to include after a certain. I'd say maybe I don't know. I have an RCA from I think 1934, and I have an All Wave. It's a very good set, but the top of the line is that All Wave with the phonograph added, and then that would be sort of the flagship item for the season, huh?
Well, the phonographs were, you know, that was the primary form of entertainment other than radio at that point.
And
so they were very popular.
And, you know, for RCA, certainly it was a bonanza because RCA had that relationship with Victrola, having bought Victrola, and they made an awful lot of records, you know, for people to go out and buy, huh?
Oh, yeah. You know, it really served the industry well to put that in there. Again, it's selling the razor to buy the to sell the blades.
Yeah, self-promotion.
Giving away the razor, yeah.
Self-promotion at its finest. And so let's see here, just to get into this a little bit. This would have presented a whole different challenge for the radio repair technician going in to work on a set now. He's got the phonograph to work on. And were they very challenging for the technician?
They were because, you know, all the record changers are fairly, you know, they're fairly complicated mechanical items. And, you know, some of them have the ability to sense the record size automatically. Many of them, some of them had the ability to flip the record over.
Wow, I had no idea that they were that complex. You know, go ahead.
Oh, and it was complicated by the fact that at the time the records were made out of shellac, and so were actually kind of fragile. If you drop the record too hard or you mishandled it in any way, it could easily crack.
Yeah, so like when you see it on the Three Stooges, you know, being a connoisseur of fine entertainment, and, you know, Mo hits Larry over the head with the record, it actually would probably break like that. You know,
it would break like that. Yeah, I think it was pre-cracked. It would raise a big bump on your head to do that. But try that with a modern vinyl record.
Yeah, and you'd get nothing but frustration out of it. So,
right.
And, you know, something else that I learned, a little sidelight, and I was just doing some reading on some recording artists, and, you know, the V-disc, well, I just thought the V-disc would happen to be a record that was made during, you know, the war years, but apparently V-discs were specially made because sort of the commercial production of 78 stopped because shellac was taken for the war, and I had no idea of that.
Well, actually, there were two problems they were trying to solve. Shellac was getting scarce, so records for home consumption, while still made with shellac, were often filled with things like sawdust.
Yeah.
So they started adding fillers to the home records, but you couldn't easily ship a shellac record overseas. It was too likely to break. So that's when they started to shift to vinyl, and hence the V and V disc.
Ah, I see. So, you know, just
double entendre.
More more knowledge than I know what to do with here. Now, you know, if the radio with the phonograph presented some challenges for the well-qualified, you know, Philco repairman of his day, who had been to Philco Institute and all, what type of challenges do these things present to the restorer, you know, the radio restoration guy now, who has always worked in the past on working on radio sets? Now he gets a nice big RCA with the phonograph attached to it. Are there common problems that you tend to see with these things? Were they belt driven, or were they direct drive, or is it bands that would go on them, or what tended to be the common problems?
Yeah, most of them were driven with an idler wheel.
Okay.
So, you know, I mean, excuse me, I've got a bit of a cold.
Oh, no problem.
The typical problems you see, you know, if you buy one from a dealer, or, you know, even worse, you pick one up, as I often do, at a flea market. The first challenge is the grease they use to grease the mechanism, because there's a lot of sliding parts, tends to turn to a sort of varnish, dries up and becomes very sticky. So you have to get that out of there and get the thing re-greased. Another problem, if it's been in the human environment, is rust starts to creep in, and you have to deal with that. The third problem, as you mentioned, these things use rubber wheels for drive, and they will typically dry out and crack, or they will develop flat spots over the years, so they often have to be replaced. The good news is the mechanisms themselves were pretty robust, more so than the modern record players. These things were made out of stamped steel for the most part. So, you know, I mean, if you take care of those items, then, you know, I mean, then you have a good chance of bringing the thing back to life.
Now, how about the needle itself? You know, because that's something we always think about with any phonograph. You know, do those age well, or is that something that tends to really take a beating?
Well, the very early ones used, you know, a variety of mechanisms involving light beams or disc or magnetic coils to try to capture the movement. Okay, you see the hammerhead type cone arm are typically that way, and if they work, they work. If not, you've got a problem. After that, in the piezoelectric or crystal cartridge, and those will deteriorate with age. The crystals absorb water, and they will sort of crumble apart. You can rebuild them. I've tried this a couple of times with somewhat success, actually using a piezoelectric element from one of those little speakers you can buy in Radio Shack.
Uh-huh.
Or you can, there are companies who rebuild them, or you can buy, there's pretty good stock of replacement cartridges out there. Voice of Music Appreciation, I'll have to find their website in a moment, but they have a pretty good stock of replacements for ceramic, for crystal cartridges. They use ceramic, and the ceramic cartridges have similar characteristics, but they're much more rugged.
Yeah, I think I've seen the folks from Voice of Music. I think they run an ad very regularly in Antique Radio Classified, or they used to. You're trying to get a line on them. Now, here's my next question, because I do not have a radio phonograph in my collection. How do these things sound? Now, you know, I know they're not going to sound like a component system, but what was the sound quality like? How good were those old 78s, and how good was it reproduced on, you know, if you bought a good quality radio phonograph from, say, a Philco or an RCA, you know, a reputable maker?
Well, in all honesty, you know, the sound quality was not great. You know, the mechanism suffered from, you know, some inherent limitations being mechanical. There was often a fair amount of rumble and noise from the mechanism itself. But moreover, the records had a fairly limited frequency response.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if you've inherited your, you know, some relative's collection of 78 jazz records, having one is absolutely priceless.
Yeah, and, you know, the other thing, too, is, you know, it sort of gives you that spirit of the times. You know, you're hearing what was heard, and it's not something that's been taken, though, you know, I mean, it is nice when you get some of these recordings that I know, you know, they bring into studios and they do all types of wizardry of trying to, you know, remove background noise and hiss and scratch and, you know, try to clean the thing up for you. But, it, you know, if you have, you know, some Bing Crosby from the 40s and you're lucky enough to pop it on and you have a working phonograph to listen to it on, you know, you really did get to hear what Granddad was listening to, which is very cool, which is why a lot of people still listen, you know, to the antique radio. It may not sound as good as some modern equipment, but it captures that time, that feeling, and sort of the spirit of the whole thing. Now, maybe you could give the audience an idea, because this certainly sounds like something you're knowledgeable with. Is this something you restore a lot of, or you see a lot of when people bring something in for you to repair?
I've done about four or five in the past year. Typically, somebody will have a console that they'll bring in that, you know, has the phonograph with it. They want it restored. Most recently, I'm working on a Zenith Cobra-matic 8664. It's one of those. It's got the round bullet-shaped dial, and the phonograph is just the styling on it with a snake-like tone arm and a stabilizer arm. It's got the head like a cobra.
Yep.
It's just gorgeous.
Yeah, you know, that is cool. That's really cool.
It was amazing to get it to work. It probably, in terms of if I wanted to sell it, it probably wouldn't have been worth it. But it's just a cool thing to look at and it's just neat to listen to. And when you do put these things on, really, people don't focus on the lack of quality. There's just a wow. I've never heard one of those before, especially among the younger set.
Right. The experience is actually, you know, the device working as it should with all its imperfections, you know, because yeah. Honestly, somebody will sit down, you know, 50 years from now and they'll, you know, bemoan, you know, our best audio equipment that we have now and how do those people deal with it and blah, blah, blah. But no, it really is, you know, the goal of the restoration is to get it to be just like it was and, you know, to marvel at it, you know, mechanically for what it was. Now, the thing with the Cobra-matics was I've seen those discussed, you know, when I kind of first came back into the hobby, I, you know, had a couple of books and I was reading a Zenith book on the glory years and I see this reference to Cobra-matic and I'm trying to figure this out. Well, is it because the arm was particularly flexible? I'm trying to figure out why did they call it this. I did not understand, you know, sort of the whole Cobra thing. And especially, you know, I saw one. I had the good fortune to be at somebody's shop once, and he had one in there. And I looked at this thing. And I said, this is crazy. It's so cool. And, you know, the other thing, we had a fascinating discussion one evening. We had Ron Ramirez on from the Philco Forum, and we had a little talk about, you know, the Philco, music on a beam of light. And, you know, in sort of a distant way, you know, maybe a precursor even to, you know, to the laser, the CDs that we have now. But, you know, just sort of even that idea that, you know, music could be picked up that way and then played through the speaker. So, you know, there is some very neat technology involved. And it's certainly, you know, a little bit more than meets the eye when you just say, quote unquote, phonograph. A lot of people think of, you know, those things that you used to see, you know, if you're about my age, you know, when you were in elementary school, you think of this thing that had the gray cover that lifted up, and that would be something they would play those French-speaking records on to try to drill you to get you, especially me, you know, somebody who was lost with French and then had a, you know, wanted to speak French with a horrible Boston accent, and we'd listen to those things over and over again. Well, that really wasn't a very neat phonograph, but certainly the ones that were integrated into the console radios were. And, you know, some of them, I know there are people who are very fond, you know, they have sort of a I won't say cult following, but a unique following, people who are into Fisher audio. And I know that there were some turntables with entertainment systems that Fisher did, especially, you know, later years after the war and all, that sounded quite good. And Magnavox has certainly a following on some of their later models that, you know, even the fidelity started to get better and the records were getting better too. I know RCA had a lot of improvements with their records, did that whole big thing on, I can't recall the, you know, hi-fi sound, you know, living stereo, I think they started to call it.
Yeah, well, a couple of things happened. One was the invention of the magnetic cartridge, which really was a much better mechanism for capturing the sound off the grooves because of its greater compliance. You could follow rapid groove movements much more easily. And the other thing is they realized that normal sound has rather low frequencies or at a high amplitude, typically, and the higher frequencies, although there's a lot of energy there, it doesn't create as much amplitude or swing in the needle. So what they started to do is they started to record with amplified high frequencies, lower low frequencies, and they reversed the process on playback, kind of an early Dolby.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so when you hear about equalization, that was what they did, and it really made a big difference in the sound.
Yeah, and you know, things start to, you know, get to the point. I can remember, this is, who knows, if you're from the Boston area, you might remember, I think my parents, and I don't know if they got it at Jordan Marsh, or, you know, a lot of stuff came into my house from Jordan Marsh. We had a little Magnavox. Now, this was a Magnavox automatic record player with a record changer. It could take up to 5 records. It had the adapter for the 45s, but this was sans a radio. It did not have the radio in it, and I know some did. But, you know, I have to say, looking back on it, because I played a lot of stuff on it, and, you know, as I started to get a little older and as I thought, you know, much hipper, I was playing Beatles and, you know, Simon and Garfunkel on it. And you know, for what it was, I thought the sound wasn't bad.
No, it was at the time. Yeah, I mean, and some people, even to this day, prefer it over digital sound. They feel it's got a much more as in tube radios.
Yep.
They think the sound is subjectively is much more pleasing. But I remember in 1958 was the very first stereos started to come out, and my father brought home a console with a stereo in it, turntable and amplifier. And they were making records specifically designed to show the stereo, you know, very hard on one channel.
Right.
Another channel. And we just sat there going, whoa, that's pretty neat.
That is cool. Do you remember what brand it was?
Oh, I really can't remember. I think I was about 8 years old.
Yeah. So it's funny what you do remember, then things that just seem to vanish. Now, in general, I mean, I guess, you know, generalities are always tough, but if we go back to, say, the 30s and the 40s, were some record players, were some phonographs in the radios better quality than others? Was there a certain manufacturer that tended to really do things right, or was it sort of the, you know, you get what you paid for? If you went up the line and you bought a more premium radio that had a phonograph in it, was it generally better materials and better quality, or is it just really sort of hit or miss?
Well, generally, the price drove the features of it. So, you know, I mean, as with the radio itself, you know, I mean, the more you paid, the more robust the system you got. But they all pretty much had the same basics. Many of the turntables were purchased from turntable manufacturers like Oak and Capehart, and installed in the units rather than made by the radio manufacturers as well. Because it was a pretty specialized sort of thing.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know, we had on Alex Magoon, and he's a sound off whiz kid and knows a lot about RCA, and we kind of touched a little bit on it, but I know when RCA acquired Victrola Talking Machine Company, you know, they got not only all the intellectual property, and, you know, I don't know if any of that manufacturing capacity was used to, you know, make special phonographs that wound up in RCA sets, but I always sort of had in the back of my head that some of the RCA stuff might be pretty good given that, you know, history with Talking Machine Company.
Yeah, actually, I have not seen a lot of RCAs, but it's just, you know, what seems to come in the door. So I really couldn't comment on that. But,
yeah.
You know, they seem to have, they did have a good reputation at the time.
Yeah, and I know they did their whole thing with the, you know, they were big. And you see a lot of them, these Bakelite record players, especially for the 45s. You know, you'll see them at swaps and at flea markets, the you know, the little Victrolas, and we had on a fellow who had actually written a book about them, and, you know, I had no idea of, you know, all the you know, technology that goes into it. It's easy for the modern observer to sit and just look at something as, okay, it's a box with a rubber band and a needle, and, you know, somehow they put some power in there and they manage to get some sound out of the thing. But when you talk to people who have a good feel for it and they can actually tell you some of the technology that went into it, some of the stuff is actually fairly impressive for its day. And I, you know, I guess that goes with the phonographs and with the radios as well. It's the thing I tend to admire is that some of this stuff was so well thought out, and there were so many patents involved, and there were so many interesting concepts involved. I mean, I had no idea that there was something that would actually flip a record for you. And I imagine the more sophisticated these changers and record players got, with more moving parts and, again, more features, the more difficult they became to repair, and the more likely they became to need repair. I mean, what was the lifespan on something like that? Did those hold up pretty well?
That was why the slippers never really caught on.
Yeah, too many problems.
It got too complicated. You know, with a little TLC, I'm getting some of those running from the late 30s or early 40s. They're running today. Again, they were very ruggedly built. You know, I mean, if you clean it out, and, you know, I use a little WD-40 or some, you don't have to take it apart, but, you know, just use some mineral spirits on a Q-tip, get all the old grease out of there. If there's no rust, you're in good shape. You re-grease the sliding parts. The motor, generally, does not use grease, that uses oil. But don't use 3-in-1 oil. You should use a small motor oil, or what they call turbine oil. You can buy it at the hardware store. And that's got usually a felt pad. You can just sort of put a bunch of oil in there, and even if it's kind of sticky when you start, if you rotate it a while and just leave it, it should start to move up again. And just work the parts by hand. Don't plug it in. You know, you can just turn the turntable a few times. Check the take the turntable off. Check the idler wheel. If that's in fairly good shape, you get some rubber renews to soften that up a bit, or you can get a replacement from VM Audio Enthusiast. I think Radio Days also has a stock of these things. You know, you can check around the web. If it's got a crystal cartridge, you probably just want to replace it with one of the replacement ones. And, you know, you're talking, you know, $25, $30 for something like that.
Well, you know what,
word of warning, though, if you're thinking of flipping one of these, generally they don't have a much value on the resale market.
But we just want to
doing this for your own pleasure.
We want to hit the pause here real quick and just remind everybody, this is Tube Talk on WRCA. This is the show for the music lover and the vintage radio enthusiast. Our guest tonight is Alan Finger, and we're discussing radio phonographs and just phonographs on their own from the 30s, 40s, and 50s. And yeah, I was going to ask you how do these things do on their own? Is, you know, obviously we're very, you know, we're in the hobby of collecting radio, but are there separate groups? I mean, are there people who are just into the phonograph end of things? And, you know, if it wouldn't command a lot of money, a restored phonograph, it sounds like maybe that's a smaller hobby, not as big as the radio hobby.
Yeah, there's a market for there's a significant market for the old acoustic phonographs.
Mm-hmm.
But I have not seen a specific market for radio phonograph combinations. There is a market for some of the newer stereo equipment, '50s, '60s, '70s stereo equipment. And there's a website dedicated to that called videokarma.com.
Yep, I'm familiar with them. You know, that's a growing part of the hobby, and it fits so nicely with radio. I mean, you will go to different meets, or at least I've gone, and we mentioned this before on the show. You start to see, Marantz and Pioneer and vintage Kenwood stuff. You know, I remember when I was a teenager showing up, and along with that, you know, are some of the Techniques and Garrod turntables and, a variety of different brand names. I know some of the like stores like Tech Hi-Fi, they carry probably half a dozen of them. But you're starting to see that stuff now, because that's the
generation that wants to, you know, recapture its youth, and that was the stuff that was popular. And, you know, the radio phonograph, while big in its day, it seems to be fading even with the radio collector. But it is neat, you know, if you have that console set with the phonograph. Of course, you want everything functioning, and you know, your phonograph is part of that. And you know, I certainly see a variety of different venues, old records and 78s. I still run into those a lot. I don't know about your experience.
Yeah, you see a lot of them on eBay. I've gone to the flea market. I've seen 78s. I've also seen some of the old cylinders.
Yep, I've seen those.
Never
yep.
made it into the electronic phonograph, but they were actually fairly popular up until the mid-20s.
Yeah, I had the good fortune to see a cylinder, a little demonstration. A guy had one at a swap meet, and I have to say, well, you know, the sound left something to be desired. You know, it was like being on the History Channel. You know, it was really cool to see. And he had a collection of cylinders. And I think our pal Ross has told me once there's a fellow who does a show on WBCQ, and all he does is play cylinders. And, you know, some things are very unusual that he has on these cylinders. And, you know, again, it's as much for the history as it is for the device. It's not going to wow you with sound. But it is kind of interesting to listen to something that people thought at that stage was worth recording, because it's not all music, you know?
It is. The interesting thing is that from a technical standpoint, the cylinders actually were a better technology in many ways than the discs, because they you don't have that problem of going from a big diameter to a little one. And they really lost out in terms of being manufacturable in mass quantities more than anything else, because you could stamp a record.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing that I never really was familiar with until I read an article, it might have been in ARC or it might have been in one of the club newsletters, was the wire recorder, you know, which was this whole, you know, separate ball of wax. And I don't know if any of those were ever incorporated with a radio, but Silvertone had them, I guess, and, you know, it was, you know, people could record at home. And I believe some radio phonographs were used, because I've seen on radio ads from the period things that said, make your own recordings.
I've got a Silvertone in the basement, which is one of those Round Tuit projects, which is, in fact, a record recorder. And that was in the 30s and 40s. If you wanted to record your voice,
sure,
you know, that you could purchase one of these, or you could go. In fact, most cities had studios or booths where you could go and you could make a recording and send it to a loved one.
Yeah, that's good. You know, if you happen to have one of those, I mean, what a keepsake, you know, for your family. This fellow who had written the article, you know, had found this thing in a closet, and apparently, you know, he found some of the reels for the, you know, then they had, you know, recordings of family birthdays and different. I mean, he was just awestruck. He says, this is just, you know, it's the jackpot, you know, rather than go in and you find an old family photograph album. You know, how cool would it be to hear your great-grandfather you never met, you know, telling your father happy birthday? I mean, that is just really neat stuff. And, you know, again, until I, you know, stumbled across it, I never really thought of that technology being in the average home, you know, from that period in time.
It was, and wire recorders never really caught on in the United States. You know, I mean, they were used for dictation.
Maybe, uh-huh. Yeah, for like offices and that type of thing.
But, you know, you could go and you could make a record and send it to your boy in the Army.
Well, it was sort of, maybe that was your version of American Idol. You know, we'd send those off. I'm sure there was somebody who thought they were the best singer or musician in the world that must have bombarded some poor guy at a radio station somewhere. He probably had hundreds of other things, and he said, could you just stop it? I don't even want to hear it anymore. But
well, I remember there was a rebirth of that in the late 60s, early 70s, when the little portable tape recorders came out.